There are some positive signs for manufacturing this week. You know, manufacturing, actually building things, Americans still do it. A report today from the Commerce Department shows that businesses ordered more factory goods in November. Earlier this week, we heard that manufacturing expanded for the 17th straight month in December, and factories are reportedly cranking up for even more production, anticipating that tax cuts will give people more incentive to buy computers and electronics and give businesses a comfort zone to invest in more equipment. On the other hand, the manufacturing industry has shed more than 2 million jobs. That's about a quarter of the jobs lost since the beginning of the recession. And right now, the U.S. runs a $50 billion trade deficit in advanced technology goods. Because other countries are selling back to the U.S. $50 billion worth of things that were invented right here but are built elsewhere. Well, enter the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. MIT President Susan Hockfield recently put together a panel of engineers, scientists, and economists who will begin to look into how to revive manufacturing in the U.S. Susan Berger is co-chair of the new panel. She's a professor of political science at MIT, also author of the book How We Compete, What Companies Around the World Are Doing to Make It in Today's Global Economy. And Susan joins us in the studio to take a look at building things in America. Welcome.
Thank you.
You know, this topic has provoked a lot of conversation around the office. You know, people saying, no, do we really still make things? What does the U.S. make?
Well, actually, the United States is the world's largest contributor of manufacturing goods.
Really?
We make about 23% of the world's manufactured goods, and it's the same share of the total world pie as we made 30 years ago.
Really?
So how is it, you might wonder, if we're still making such a large fraction of the world's manufacturing goods, how come we're only employing today something like 10% of the workforce in manufacturing, whereas in the past was something more like double that amount? The answer to that is that we've become enormously productive. And so it takes fewer and fewer people to make the same bag of goods. Productivity increases is the largest part of the story. And then trade does account for some much smaller part of the story. We're importing a lot of the goods that we used to make at home.
And when people, this is the other thing that people think about manufacturing and tell us if it's mythology, that the reason that we don't have as many people making things here is that other countries have lower wages.
Well, what really matters is not wage rates. It's unit labor costs. So the question is, how many hours of work is it going to take to make this table? And if we can make the table in a half an hour using a worker who's paid $20 an hour, whereas in China it might take three workers working a day, that table is still going to be cheaper if it comes from the United States.
So the labor may have been more expensive, but the end product is less expensive. You have another example of that. You traveled to Romania, where an Italian clothing maker had moved a factory. Now, they still had Italian workers back home, but they were now also taking advantage of the cheaper Romanian labor.
And the Italian manager of the company, she was so proud of her Romanian workers, and she showed me two baskets of knitted white sleeves. And she said, guess which ones my Romanian workers made? Guess which ones my Italian workers made. And I couldn't guess. And she said, well, she said, it's true, I'm really proud of our Romanian workers, but those white sleeves here in Romania, they're 50% more expensive to make. I said, that can't be possible. Your workers here are only paid a tenth of what they're paid in Italy. She said, yes, but the material that the sleeves are made of is very expensive. So anytime the machine breaks down, and any of the material, any of this beautiful white Angora wool is wasted, that's very expensive for us. And our Italian workers, they can hear when the machine is about to break down. They stop the machine before we waste any of the wool. Those workers, they know how to fix the machine. We don't have to bring in a technician from far away.
And that's the unit labor cost.
And that's the unit labor cost. That's why, even though wages are 10 times less in Romania than they were in Italy, still it cost 50% more to make those sleeves there.
Well, here's another, and you tell me if this is a myth about manufacturing. We think that, you know, the people that actually build something and put it together, that Americans don't want to do that anymore, that they don't want to do the work of on the factory floor manufacturing.
Well, in the first place, we now have 10% unemployment, and I think you'd find a lot of people who would be grateful to have a good, solid manufacturing job. And I think that as manufacturing jobs have disappeared in the United States, we've seen that people who had been earning $20, $25 an hour in manufacturing jobs and also with health benefits, they've gotten new jobs, before the economic crisis at least, but they got jobs at Walmart wages with Walmart health benefits, which is to say virtually no health benefits, and earning something like $8 an hour. So I really think that we would find that there are a lot of people in the United States who would be very glad to have good manufacturing jobs.
What are some of the things we make?
We make airplanes, we make automobiles, we make medical devices. I mean, even in industries that you'd think of as kind of largely migrated out of the United States, we see exciting new companies. Take something like American Apparel. They make T-shirts in downtown Los Angeles, and their workers earn well above the minimum wage. So I think the question is not that whole industries need to close down in the United States. The question is, how do we introduce innovation across a set of industries, both some old industries and some new industries that we think can emerge?
And by the way, back to that myth that, well, you know, it's the union's fault, the wages are too high here. You and others at MIT give examples of other industrious countries like Germany
Sure.
that pay very well and still manage to keep jobs.
So Germany's wages are much higher than U.S. wages. And Germany has, 15 to 18% of its workforce in manufacturing. In Denmark, even a larger fraction of, and also a very high-wage society. Sweden, whose economic growth this year is superior to that of any other country in Western Europe, Sweden has high wages and a very significant manufacturing sector.
What are they doing differently? Or is this what you want to find out?
Well, we know, just for starters, that their workforce is far better educated than our workforce. In the United States, about half the population gets a really good education, and half the population just barely makes it through high school, if it makes it there. And so we have to ask how we can do a better job educating Americans for the new kinds of skills and the new jobs.
We're talking about the future of manufacturing in the U.S., building things, with MIT professor Suzanne Berger. She's co-chair of MIT's new panel of engineers, scientists, economists, all looking into reviving manufacturing in the U.S. And Suzanne, before the break, you gave an example of some industrialized countries that, unlike the U.S., are still able to employ a large percentage of people in well-paying manufacturing jobs. Germany, Denmark, Sweden. You said they're doing a better job of educating people through the schools, but also a better job of educating employees once they're on the job.
German employers, Japanese employers, Danish employers, they invest heavily in upgrading the skills of their employers. And the reason that that matters is that if you want your workforce to be a flexible one, if you want to be able easily to hire and fire people, you need to be able to have workers who themselves have good chances of getting good jobs when they leave your company. So in Denmark, for example, employers are free to hire and fire at will, and their workers easily find new jobs because they're very well-educated workforce. And so if we really want to have the kind of industries we want and the kind of jobs we want, we've got to start with a huge effort on education that we're not making now. And I think we have to also look at investment because if we've looked at what really flourished in the United States in the decade before the financial and economic crisis, it was really Wall Street. And we saw that a large part of the American economy and growth in the American economy was growth in financial products. And it's very hard to see exactly how those financial markets and the products they created contributed to the real economy.
John Cassidy talks about this in the New Yorker magazine, that all Wall Street started doing was churning money around and exchanging it among very wealthy people and creating these financial instruments. But building financial instruments is not like manufacturing. Well, there was a similar push by MIT back in the 1980s to help out U.S. manufacturing. This is when Japan was such a giant and threatened trade. And you were involved.
Yes, I was a young faculty member, and this was an extraordinary experience. And the results of that study, I think, really had a deep impact.
One of the results was the book Made in America. It sold 60,000 copies. Productivity and manufacturing did rebound in the 90s. The sector added thousands of jobs. But the Harvard Business Review says that some of the success after the work of MIT in the 80s might have been some of the bubbles that got inflated, and that the real problem of manufacturing didn't get addressed then, but it has to be addressed now.
I think that many of the real problems were not addressed, and I guess I would come back to education. If I look now back at the Made in America volume, and I ask myself which part of our recommendations really were followed and which part not, I would say that the story on education, it's just no better than it was 20 years ago. I think that there's been a tremendous change in the economy over the last 20 years, and that so we're looking at a very different world. 20 years ago, we were looking at big companies that carried on almost all of their activities within their own four walls. And so everything from research, development, design, through manufacturing, and then into distribution took place in within a big company. But what's happened is production really today does not take place within the four walls of a single company. I remember one of our engineers at MIT describing how when, as a young engineer, he started work at Hewlett-Packard, and if they wanted to make a mask is what gets placed, it's like a stencil that goes onto silicon, and you trace out on it the integrated circuits, that the engineer stood next to the technician, and the technician had a razor in his hand, and the engineer and the technician worked together on cutting out the mask. And the technician stood there with his razor and cut. Today, the engineer draws the circuits on his computer, and he can send a complete digital file to a cutting machine anywhere in the world. He doesn't need to stand next to the technician anymore. Yeah. And so these two activities now can take place in completely different companies. And that's what's happened. The world of production has been completely broken up into independent companies that are located. The business school jargon for this is companies organized around core competence, core capabilities. So IBM got rid of all its, or most of its chip making. IBM no longer makes computers. IBM has focused much more narrowly on its business services. New companies in the United States, like Cisco, Broadcom, Qualcomm, these are companies that never manufactured anything and still don't manufacture anything. They're design companies. They bring their products up through the design and prototype stage, and then they're manufactured somewhere else in the world by other people. So today we're looking at a world of networks in which companies connect to each other, and we just haven't figured out yet in the United States how in this new networked economy to create new manufacturing activities and jobs. And I think that's what's really new about the last 20 years. We just haven't worked out this part of the puzzle. And I think as we look across new technologies, we're going to see a lot of areas in which keeping manufacturing closer to R&D and to design is going to be essential if we want to be able to produce good products.
Certainly closer than, India.
Yeah.
That's Suzanne Berger, professor of political science at MIT. She is co-chair of the new panel at MIT that's researching ways to revive aspects of manufacturing in the U.S. Suzanne, fascinating. Thanks for talking to us about
Thank
it.
You.